You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 495.IS4915. Certificate number 43431. Foundling Wheels. There's a lot of numerological sort of symphony there in those numbers. 495. 4915 and 43431.
There's a music of the spheres.
Yeah. Is there a Kabbalah thing I'm missing here?
Have you noticed that sometimes when you get that 6-digit code that they text you to let you log into a website, are you aware of this kind of second order security now?
Yeah.
I hate it. I'm sure it's keeping people from taking my identity or something, but I hate to wait to get a text because now I can't look at my checking account.
I had to do a thing on DocuSign the other day, and they were like, now go to the email and get the code and put it into the phone to get... And I'm like, I use this all the time. And then, I get there.
It's me, John.
And they had no recollection of the actual document that I was trying to... So I had to go back and get the...
But have you noticed when you get the 6-digit code, it often seems to be very fortuitous in some way? Do you ever notice this?
You mean that's your birthday or your social security number?
It's like you're saying there's some kind of music to it. It's like instead of just being 6 random numbers, somehow it's 841846 or something like... And is it just because all numbers have patterns that jump out because that's how our chimp brains work?
I think maybe, even though most of the time my phone will autofill that stuff, I think maybe there's also a sense that you give somebody something that's easy to remember so they can click from their email to their thing. And
that's what I'm wondering. Like, is there an algorithm that's like, okay, we'll give them a 6-digit code, but it won't be a random one. It'll have enough repetition that they can remember it in their head while they switch from phone to laptop or whatever.
If you
work in that field, let us know.
Have you ever thought about telling people your phone number, but in like the first two digits being 2-digit increments, like 2929609 instead of...
That always seems weird when you're...
292.
Because other countries will do that, right?
Yeah.
Here's my number. It's a 2, a 3, and another 2.
Right. 4422-1102.
Maybe that is because it's like a combination lock.
Yeah.
Or like a set of measurements. Remember when old-timey people were like
2 cubits.
No, when they would like, when three 2-digit numbers would be enough for them to get horny. 35, 23, 32, ay, ay, ay.
Oh, you're like someone's bust
measurements?
Yeah,
like measurements. Do you remember? That was actually a signifier for...
She's 36, 24, 36. I do remember. That's such a Playboy magazine.
Yeah, I'm young enough that to me it seems like a very... even to me, it seems old timey.
Yeah.
But you like, you'll still have song lyrics where that's some measure of sexiness is to recite a combination lock combination.
I found a book of dirty jokes that, was meant to hang in a toilet. It actually has a little chain through the book, and it's called something like John's, you know, something for the John. And it's a long hardback book full of,
you're like, it's actually amazing.
1960s dirty jokes. And it has lots of little Playboy era cartoons. And so I got this thing and I had it in my little library of dirty books. And for whatever reason, I took it out. I was reading it and left it on the coffee table. And my daughter found it. And I saw her pick it up and I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Don't touch that. That's the book of dirty jokes from ye olden times. And it's not for children's. And she, you know, put it down, but she's, you know,
that's the guaranteed way to keep kids away from a book permanently.
She's an avid reader and often has said to me like, oh, I don't want to watch kissing in a movie, but I can read a book where there's kissing because it's a book and I can handle it in a book. And she came to me the other day and she was like, can I please look at that book of dirty jokes? And I said, no, I just feel like it's too, there's too much in that that you're not going to understand. And she was like, but it's a book. I can figure it out. And I was like, I think no. Stop. What, so
is there a replacement text you can recommend to her? Like, what's the entry level version of Totally Tasteless Jokes 7?
Yeah, right. Like dirty limericks. I don't know. Somebody sent us a calendar here at Omnibus that was like a joke a day calendar, and I gave it to her and a lot of puns.
But it turned out they were half dirty jokes.
No, she loves it. Oh. Every day she takes the joke, she pins it to her bulletin board. She looks at it, and then she has now on her wall a little section of her favorite jokes from the last year.
Well, none of this has anything to do with Foundling Wheels.
Say what?
Did you realize this was you just riffing on the numbers?
Wait, are we still recording?
Welcome to Free Association Podcast. You're on the FAP network. Yeah,
you are years in.
That's actually a good acronym for this, Free FAP. Association Podcast. FAP. So we've talked about how we are in an age of South Korean domination of world culture, right?
Do you want to hear a story?
The Hallyu era. Is it about South Korean domination of world culture?
It is. We have a favorite sushi restaurant here in Seattle or in Burien.
Okay.
And it's obviously a family-run thing. And the server is this very enthusiastic young woman. And then the assistant chef is her husband. And then the sushi chef is an older man.
And are they Korean, as is the case in many Seattle sushi restaurants?
Well, and this is the thing. All the stuff in the sushi restaurants, all samurai and all, you know, Kirin beer and just sushi, you know, Japanese.
A lot of these places have a second menu where it's like, and here's the chapcha and the, you know, that's got all the Korean.
And this doesn't have that. And I've asked for it. I'm like, is there another menu? No. And she is very much like Haraguchi girl energy.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, very like high pitched. And so I was having lunch there the other day, and the person I was dining with said, where in Japan are you from? Because she's always wearing a mask. She still wears a mask. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, we're Korean. And then we had a very long conversation about Koreans serving Japanese food. And she was, you know,
you were talking with her about this.
Yeah. She's from Seoul. She's been here for 10 years. This is her husband. And I said, oh, is he like an assistant? Or like an apprentice? And she was like, barely. Like, she's really dissing on him pretty hard. But so I wanted to know your experience of Korean sushi restaurants. Is this a big thing in Seattle?
It's a pretty common thing here. I think there's at least a perception among a Korean immigrant population that that it's easier to find American diners for sushi than for Korean food. And that might be, even in the Hallyu era of everyone loving all things Korean, maybe that's true. Maybe that's old news though. Like, maybe if you were actually serving, maybe today those people come here and they serve Korean style fried chicken and corn dogs and all this LA inflected Korean food.
She said that there was a new Korean restaurant opening in Burien and she couldn't wait. And I said, couldn't you just serve bulgogi here?
Stop serving sushi?
And she was like, no, that stuff's too hard to to make. We're onto the sushi thing.
I wonder if there is some kind of, you know, economic or logistical reason why you'd want to just serve sushi.
Yeah. She said, no, we're just going to go to the one up the street when it opens.
But yeah, there are plenty of these, and the teriyaki places are the same way. You know, it's Japanese food, but it's Korean immigrant families or second generation. And if you ask, they might have a second menu and they'll serve you some kimchi jjigae or something.
Yeah, you remember when all of the teriyaki and like cheap Chinese food places up on Capitol Hill, they were all Vietnamese families.
Right.
Yeah.
That
was before they realized we were addicted to pho.
Yeah, like
they could
have switched to pho and bulgogi, like, and we would have been like, oh, is this better?
This is kind of great.
Are we allowed to say this is better? So Korean culture is having a moment, and this is no longer a niche thing.
We're 9 minutes into the show, by the way.
And we haven't gotten anywhere. But interestingly, just last year, Korean adoption was kind of having a moment. There were two...
I thought that wasn't cool anymore.
Well, right. Discourse around Korean adoption,
okay,
right. Specifically Korean international adoption, was the subject of two... you know, foreign language movies, but, you know, movies that got big enough U.S. releases for there to be think pieces in a lot of magazines. One is called Return to Seoul, about a Korean-French woman, a Korean adoptee to France, coming back for the first time and trying to find her birth parents, and based closely on some real-world experiences. And the second is called Broker, and it's a little more... interesting. It's a little more elaborate. It's by a Japanese director, and it's about what the Korean adoption world is like today, including kind of an underbelly, a black market world of people trying to assemble high bidders for desirable orphans.
There was a big article just recently on adoption in one of the either Atlantic or New Yorker, and I have a lot of adoption. Proximity in my larger world, friends that discovered or had to find their parents in adulthood and became part of that adoption recovery movement.
It's a community now, and that's kind of it's a weirdly recent thing.
Yeah.
And the internet era. Like,
there was a big part of the article that was about Korean adoptees that it turns out it was not all...
Are any of these friends of yours international adoptions or Korea in particular?
Yeah, and I've known Korean adoptees who really struggle because, you know, they encounter kids in school whose parents are Korean and they're from Korea, and there's all that identity crisis thing of like, well, I'm Korean, but I don't speak any Korean and don't know anything about Korea.
It was a huge diaspora. It started with the Korean War. And, you know, at first, I think it was a lot of, as a result of U.S. service members, there are a lot of mixed race babies that would not have been super, super welcome in either culture at the time, and having to figure out what to do about that. And then it was just the crowded orphanages following the war, you know, a lot of, you know, generation of, yeah. A lot of people had died and there wasn't a lot of infrastructure to take care of the orphans. But it became this whole self-perpetuating thing almost through the end of the 20th century. 200,000 South Korean children were adopted overseas.
You're kidding.
During that time.
200,000?
Yeah. And that's a big enough number that even as early as the Seoul Olympics in 1988, and kind of Korea's debut on the international stage, people were wondering if it was a bad look. Korea's still a military dictatorship in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And they're wondering, do we want to be seen as the baby exporting country? That seems like the one thing we don't want to export. That's a sign that we're still...
Yeah, it doesn't seem like we're the modern country.
Right. We're still the developing country if we are a net exporter of baby. And that's actually how they refer to it, as exporting.
Wow.
And this is, I mean, you know, I also know it, you know, having lived in Korea, I know a ton of people in that world. It was commonplace for people we knew who lived there for a long period of time to consider adopting or even adopting. And I think you probably know this. My youngest sister is a Korean adoptee.
Right.
And I think that counts as an international adoption, even though we were
there.
We were living in Korea there for the next, you know, for the 4 years or so after that.
And is there
4 to 6 years?
Is there any aspect of her her story availability to be adopted that now doesn't seem like it would go down the same way? Like, are her parents still alive?
Well, certainly. I mean, my sister was I don't want to tell too much of her story because it's hers, but she was a foundling, just turned up at a local orphanage, which was not a rural orphanage, which was not an uncommon thing at the time, and later moved to a different orphanage because there was a whole system. And, you know, you've talked about the cultural dysphoria that can result for these kids when they realize they're not really a product of either culture and it's confusing. And I think for my sister specifically, and as for many adoptees, there's a lot of issues bound up in just the sense of being abandoned by somebody you can't even locate to find out what the deal is.
Yeah. I read an article recently that said that there is a whole movement suggesting that Black kids should not ever be adopted to white families.
Yep.
And whatever, you know, whatever the alternative is, that's in some
it's
ways
better. Yeah.
A white family raising a Black kid is a worse outcome. But, you know, I also know Black kids that were raised in white families who, you know, wouldn't say that maybe, but maybe would. I don't know.
I still see them occasionally here in town, and I don't know if it's, is it now religious people doing it?
In this neighborhood, my daughter has two friends, little girls, little Black girls that are being raised by lesbian couples, white lesbian couples. So it's not, I don't think it's just a Christian thing. I think it's, and I think maybe both adopted directly from Africa.
Right. That's when I see it, I'm like, oh, look, you know, probably Somali or East African immigrant adoption. And I don't know if it's domestic or international.
These are West African.
Girls. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same factors are now coming into play when we talk about international adoption and what are the, you know,
what are we even doing?
Yeah, did we even think about what the consequences would be for just removing a child from their culture, but not, obviously they're going to be curious about it. You know, they're going to be identified by outsiders as being part of that culture, but now they're not.
Because adoption has been presented my whole life as something that really is important to fulfill the people doing the adopting.
Think of these parents, this childless parents.
And a lot of people really want to raise a child and aren't able to. And I have a sister that was adopted as well. So it's a lot of, I think she's probably, I don't want to tell her story, but she's not happy about it. Like there's a lot of.
Yeah, I think the feelings can be very confusing because on the one hand, you know, you love your adoptive family, but they're all bound up with, you know, they're the thing in your life that replaced the biological family you'll never know. You know, they symbolize the cultural gap that was created if it's an international adoption.
And just like I have this personality feelings. And where does it come from? I'll never understand like why I am this way. Even the racial thing notwithstanding.
Yeah, even in adoptions of the same race, I think you're going to come up, you know, no matter how welcoming the family is, it's, you know, they might share a bunch of genetic commonalities that leads to a family culture. And, you know, you don't have to be adopted to feel like you're the outsider or the black sheep in any way. You know, I'm sure most people feel that in one way or another with their families.
Not me. I'm right down the
you're
middle.
You're the exact average of every Roderick family trait.
I am the center.
You're the platonic ideal of a Roderick.
Isn't that sad?
But beyond these kind of general philosophical questions about, is, you know, who's adoption for? Is international or intercultural adoption okay, if not why, which things can be ameliorated? There were specifically problematic things about the South Korean baby engine as it existed in the 20th century. And they
I think
were,
you should only be able to adopt a child if you killed their parents. That seems like the ancient way.
And if they have multiple children, are you obligated to adopt all of them?
No, I think you kill all but the best.
I see. You pick the best kid.
Yeah, and then raise them as your squire.
Can you choose the parents for the others, or are they just left in the savannah?
Oh, I mean, maybe your squires can take the lesser children. Who knows?
I'm going to take the best kid, and you can bring some of your siblings if you want servants.
Oh, sure. Okay.
I don't think that's the right idea, but okay.
I very seldom make you laugh to the point that you have a hard time catching your breath.
I'm glad I wasn't drinking Dr. Pepper when I heard your new adoption theory. And I'm actually going to post it online and cancel, you know. The structural problems of Korean adoption, which we can now see in hindsight, and I think people were even writing about this as early as the 1980s, was that the systems become self-perpetuating. Once it becomes a profit engine, once there's a way to bring in foreign money, it does become like any other export.
Who was profiting?
Adoption agencies were profiting. Uh-huh. International agencies would facilitate, you know, they formed in Korea to arrange these adoptions, you know, and at first it seemed like a lovely and selfless kind of a nonprofit. And in hindsight, we can see that they were propping themselves up over the decades because you've got to keep, I mean, you've got, the problem is not demand. Obviously, there's always going to be childless couples looking for a healthy baby. There's a real shortage of that in the West right now. The problem is supply. You know, once you incentivize the production of orphans, it's weird how society reorders itself to make sure you still keep getting those orphans. In any given case of a foundling, you're not going to know, you know, even at the most benign case, was there any support for the mom here? You know, you know, if the government has a way to get rid of its spare orphans that actually produces money for the military dictatorship running your country, like, why are they motivated to create better support for single moms that would allow them to keep the baby, that would, you know, measures that would allow for family planning, reducing the stigma? You know, there's a huge stigma in Korea against unmarried moms.
Oh.
And it's a patrilineal bloodline. So, you know, in Korea, the family you come from is very important, and it's patrilineal. You'll have a whole book about, you know, which Pak or which Che family you come from. And obviously, in the most common case of an orphan, there might be a way of finding out who the mother is, but for the most part, you don't know who the father is.
Yeah.
And so these kids are now very low caste and have a bunch of social problems. And if there's an easy way to ship them off to the US or Europe, the culture never has to grapple with any of that.
Oh, interesting.
And it can even get more malicious. Like, you can have cases where a baby is given up for adoption and maybe the mom wanted to keep it.
Oh, no.
But the stigma against having an unmarried kid was, or an unwed mother was such that the extended family was like, oh, no, you know, back this baby goes to a church door or an orphanage.
So is some of this now reevaluation of that a kind of revisionism around that's based in changing mores within Korea, that there's no longer, or rather that this strict caste system is starting to unravel as Korea becomes more liberal?
I think a lot of these things are still present. You know, the vast majority of these kids given away were girls, and that feeling is kind of changing, that a son is more honorable than a daughter, but, you know, still persists.
Sure.
A lot of the stigmas of against mixed race kids are lessening, but still exist. I think it's more like a case where, you know, the adoptees are facing
it's coming issues. From America.
Right. The yeah. adoptees overseas in Europe or America can now, you know, in the internet era,
have a voice.
They have found each other and now they have a community. Like, I think their first big gathering was like 1999. Whoa. You know, there were decades of this before it became a community that could speak and say, well, what about us? We didn't have a vote the first time we were A, left for up for adoption, B, adopted.
And was the meeting in Los Angeles?
I think DC. But yeah, it was not in Korea. Yeah, it was overseas kids. And I think specific abuses, you know, cases came out where it was clear that relatives had been willing to step forward and say, no, 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 like, we would have cared for the baby. And it was the adoption agency that was like, listen, you know, we've got a quota.
That's awful.
And even worse, there were cases, I think there are documented cases where a couple adopted a baby due to issues of health or whatever, the baby was sick or unable to travel, and the adoption agency would find a substitute baby.
Substitute baby?
Yeah. So it's,
What the hell is a substitute baby?
It's not a baby made of tofu. Like, they had to find a different orphan to send them instead, and they would falsify the records.
Oh.
They'd be like, oh, sure, yeah, this is little Jian, just like we said.
Oh, no. They found a different Jian.
Yeah.
And told the kid, hey, your name's Jian now?
Well, I mean, there was a ton of that anyway. You know, my sister has basically a made-up name, a made-up birthday, and, you know, made up by Holt, this international adoption agency. But, like, she's pretty sure the birthday is like maybe 6 months off. Like, they couldn't even guess her age right. Whoa. And she was only, you know, a year or two old. So
a year or two.
Yeah. I mean, 6 months makes a big difference when you're a toddler. So there were abuses, specifically of the system.
At what point is it human trafficking? Like, where's the line?
Right. Like, you're kind of bumping up against that. Right. And you asked about what the Korean culture is like today. You know, because of the end of basically overseas adoption has been, the whole system's been dismantled now and none of this is around, but there's still the same stigmas against adoption still exist to the degree that now they have to find domestic adoptive parents for their orphans. And it's basically impossible when it's not a healthy baby, you know,
or a healthy boy,
Exactly. So you have basically a lot of these orphans are condemned to just spend their whole
life in orphanage.
Yeah, in an institutional system.
Oh, no.
And from there, find a vocation or whatever. And it's just kind of understood. Basically, I think that, I have numbers here. I think it's about 11% of eligible Korean orphans are now domestically adopted. You know, your odds are like 1 in 10. And otherwise, you're in the system.
90% of them are just... And is
just in a system.
What is the orphanage system in America like? I'm ashamed to say that I don't know.
The system is not that different in America. You know, just kind of jumping to what our numbers are like. You know, I'll talk a little more about this later. But essentially, it's sometimes estimated there are as many as 12 prospective parents for every available healthy domestic baby.
Oh, wait, so it's flipped.
Yeah, exactly. But the problems are the same when it's not a baby. I think the vast majority of the kids that stay in the system are older or they have special needs or both, and they're essentially unadoptable given our current system.
Right, everybody wants a three-month-old.
And international, and the cliche of, you know, kind of the awful racialized cliche of the healthy white baby. I mean, that's what parents want. And maybe there's an upside to that kind of casual, I want a baby that looks like me racism, because it leads to, it prevents the kind of the cultural dysphoria that we've talked about.
Right.
International adoption is way down too. In 2004, international adoption to the U.S. was at an all-time high of 23,000. It's now just 3,000. It's fallen almost an order of magnitude from its peak just 20 years ago.
And I do think about that international adoption as a Christian phenomenon or a religiously powered phenomenon.
I think in general there was a ton of that. But because they had the there's two things going on here. They have the overseas aid agencies to a lot of these developing countries, so they have the pathways, and there's the sense of the individual parent that not only am I doing a good deed, I'm going to raise a Christian. Right? Like, I'm going to, you know, this baby I know will not be in Namibia, but also she will find the Lord.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a missionary zeal to it.
Can you explain just briefly, I don't know if you do have this power, but can you explain the thing about celebrities like Mia Farrow adopting like 9 kids? Like, what
Angelina Jolie.
Angelina Jolie. Like, what are those people doing? And what is that about? Aren't they busy enough? And also... I don't understand it. Do you have any insight?
Maybe I'm not at that level of celebrity.
Are they just
because I have never been like I have never hit the
I
level
love
of
that's where you went.
Shouldn't I have 7 kids from Malawi? Like, why don't I?
Yeah, but also. Like, what?
I mean, on some level, is there a cousin Oliver kind of a I should have a
like a funny young.
Yeah, why don't I have a younger? Oh, I don't have a younger, cuter kid. I mean, we adopted this kid from Burundi, but you know,
yeah,
now she's six, and you know, where's the new cuteness? I hope it's not all that, but
I mean,
these are not normal, healthy people, right?
We've They're always movie said, stars. Yeah, Mia Farrow and Angelina Jolie are egomaniacal like monsters.
Oh, really? I thought the old narrative was look at these. Look at this good work they're doing, you know, opening their homes. I remember some of that.
I think so, but I think that was the level of the magazine profile.
Yeah, that's the
like,
S-Weekly
let's piece. Look at how amazing, but then all it takes is, I mean, I think maybe the Generation X take is like, oh my God, what awful, awful people.
At least people like that, I will say, at least they have big staffs. Those kids are not going to be neglected.
Well, except who if they've already lost their real parents and now they're being raised by assistants. I don't know, it seems very strange. And you know, Angelina, Mia, if you're listening, I'm not singling you out.
We're sorry we called you out.
Yeah, I know Ronan Farrow is a listener, so it's not I'm not talking about your mom specifically.
Is that true?
Ronan?
Yeah,
Ronan. Oh yeah, he listens to every show. He writes me all the time.
I guess we should have done more like nice shows about Mia Farrow before you started to question her adoption
choices.
You mean
Ronan Sinatra?
Yeah, wink, wink. Look at those blue eyes. The on the side of adoptive parents in Korea, there's still a lot of shame around infertility because, again, these patrilineal bloodlines are so important. The idea that you couldn't produce a child really makes you less of a admirable member of society. Often couples will want to adopt secretly. They'll fake 9 months of pregnancy.
Oh,
maybe this is a business idea to, you know, you can rent increasingly larger abdomens to Korean women looking to adopt.
And then they will adopt a 2 month old or whatever.
Yeah. Look at this. Look what happened. And the specific plot of this movie Broker, which is about the Korean current black market for the babies that there are, both domestic and overseas parents. It begins outside a church where what looks like a library drop box, you know, for overdue books has been created. But you see on the CCTV, you see a woman come up and furtively slip a baby into this slot.
Well, this happens in the United States.
And sneak off into the night.
This is the whole Midwest anti-abortion fire department like drop-off box. They actually have these, and it's and I don't know how many babies go into those fire department drop-off boxes, but it's not zero.
Yeah, it's I was surprised to see it in a movie, but it turns out.
Was it a Jim Carrey movie? Because that would be weird.
Yeah, it's a Jim Carrey movie. It's set in Busan, and there it's the director is Japanese. He set the movie in Korea, possibly just because Korea dominates world culture now in a way that Japan no longer does. But he based it on a lot of news articles that have been written about a Japanese either church or community center in Kumamoto trying the same thing. And he read that it was much more common in Korea, that there's many more of these drop boxes. And it's true. It's kind of a new idea. It's not. We'll see. It's a very old idea. But it's 20th century modern incarnation. 21st century is, it's in the last 20 years or so.
How Christian is Korea?
It's fairly heavily Protestant compared to its neighbors. And I'm sure religious observance is down there like it is everywhere. But my guess is it's probably half and half.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Christian and not. Let me see. I mean, most of Korea, here are new numbers. Most of Korea would say, just like now the majority of Americans, that they are no religion at all. But Koreans actually outweigh...
You mean Christians?
Did I say Christians?
No, you said Koreans outweigh...
Oh, sorry.
Who do Koreans outweigh?
Koreans outweigh 1950s Koreans that ate less KFC. Almost 30%, just over a quarter of Korea is Protestant or Catholic. And only 15% is Buddhist, leaving about 10% to be other, you know, kind of less defined Confucian religion, I guess.
Church of Satan.
Probably a lot of Wiccans.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
So yeah, it's unusually Christian for an East Asian country. And in the particular case of this movie, the baby that's left, we find out that the community church volunteers who are supposed to be minding the baby drop just in case, they have turned off the cameras because they're going to take this baby in under the radar and make a little money by adopting it out instead of bringing it into the system. And this is something that happens now in Europe. These baby drops are common in they're found in many countries. They're especially common in Germany, Switzerland, and the Czech Republic. And I guess I was a little bit surprised to find that this is no longer the 18th or 19th century case of the wealthy master of the house seducing a servant and producing a child that has to be gotten rid of. Today, the vulnerable people are actually immigrant population.
Oh.
So in Central Europe, these are largely going to be used by young immigrant women who are vulnerable for the same reasons, though. They're economically, don't have a lot of economic power. They're in a new place. It's easy for them to get seduced and discarded once pregnant. And many of them would have religious objections against any other option besides abandoning the baby. And usually, the reason why these drop boxes, these ATM-looking devices exist is because the alternatives are often the baby that gets left somewhere less safe.
Mm.
In a New York Times piece talks about a doctor in Rome named Pier Michele Paolini, who read a news article about a baby girl just being found in the bed of a pickup truck. And what was striking about the story is she had actually been bundled up warmly. She'd clearly been, breastfed until right before before being left in the truck. And it was clear that this is somebody who loved their child, but for various social and economic reasons was unable to keep it. And he thought, well, if I loved my child, I would hate to leave it in a pickup truck. You don't want to vilify these hypothetical mothers.
I mean, can you imagine the pain of feeling pressed to do that? I think a lot of times it's not very long afterwards that they regret it and are then in a situation where they would be able better to care for it.
Twice in this movie, Broker, and often in real life, these babies are left with notes to the effect that, I'm going to come back, obviously. Right. It's kind of a pawn shop mentality. Like, I hate that my current circumstances have forced me to this, but of course I'm going to be back. Please take care of little Usung or whatever. And so this doctor in Rome said, well, look, I work at a neonatal ICU. Why does our hospital not have a better alternative to this? So he added one of these ATM-like devices to his hospital.
This is in Italy.
This is in Rome, yeah. And it turns out Rome is the location for what you might call often today they're just called baby hatches, but in the medieval and early modern periods, these were called foundling wheels.
Is the Pope Catholic?
The Pope is responsible here. Pope Innocent III, in the year 1198, according to legend, had a nightmare in which dead babies were getting scooped out of the Tiber River.
Oh, no.
And in fact, this is not a kind of a, there was a realistic basis for these fears, because often that was where unwanted babies wound up. It was not uncommon
in
the 12th century.
They didn't even make a little boat out of reeds?
Maybe no reeds in Italy. No, that's only an Egyptian option. But yeah, it's tragically, and as you mentioned, like, it's hard to just imagine the kind of extremist that a mother would have to be in to do this.
Yeah.
You know, think about what kind of awful family pressure, or, you know, the economic stringencies, addiction, mental health, you know, whatever it is. But babies were being drowned in the Tiber River to such a degree that it was a social problem. And Innocent III wakes up from this nightmare and
says, foundling wheel.
I'm the Pope. Says, yeah, there should be a new hospital. And he orders that new hospitals being built, including one called Santo Spirito, right next to the Vatican, which treated patients up through the late 20th century, you know, the oldest hospital in Europe, would have a foundling wheel. And I've read online many misconceptions of this wheel. Like, it would be it's an upright wheel, like a Ferris wheel, where the babies have to be placed in little pods that then stay upright as the wheel rotates on a Ferris wheel like axis.
Right.
No,
this all sounds like a Trent Reznor video.
No, it's a little less Terry Gilliam. You have to imagine a baby more on a lazy Susan.
Oh, okay.
The wheel is rotating on a horizontal axis.
Right. So it's
a little, a little door is opened in the side of the,
like any depository
of the convent. Yeah, exactly. It's where you would leave a bank check or whatever. Except in this case, there has to be room for a baby. The very first baby left at this Roman doctor's hospital in 2005 was actually 3 months old. So you want to have room for a variety of sizes of infant. You place it on there. I think you can close the door and then turn the wheel. Maybe you turn the wheel and then close the door. And there's some kind of bell you can ring in the medieval solution.
Right.
Even today, a lot of these come with an alarm button so that you can notify, you know, because they're not going to be, these places are not getting 30 babies a night. They're not going to be staffed in real time. You may have to essentially notify the service to come check your baby hatch.
Yeah, it does seem like a thing you'd want to alert somebody.
And in the old days, that was ringing a bell so the nuns would know, oh, there's a baby in the foundling wheel. And as a result of this papal decree, this idea spread across Europe. And, you know, of course, foundlings being left on convent porches is a cliche for a reason. It goes back to ancient Rome. You know, there was a particular column in the Roman Forum where unwanted babies could be left. And that being a more brutal time in many ways, honestly, if you didn't see anything you liked, those babies were just left to die. There was not a
You mean it was like a swap meet where you could come by and see if there was one you liked?
I mean, it's not take a baby, leave a baby. But yeah, it's absolutely, if you're in the market, come here. And it's even worse than that. People who were shopping for babies were not the childless couples of today. These were people who needed a household slave.
Right, or worse.
And yeah, exactly. And so it's trafficking at the pillar, basically.
Yeah.
And anybody who was not enslaved would be, you know, would just be left to the elements. So these solutions today are nicer. And what's interesting, you know, as we've, you know, talking about this showing up in a movie and kind of its modern technological equivalent, they came back. I think foundling wheels disappeared for centuries. And it was in 1999 that a church in Johannesburg was just getting overwhelmed with orphan babies from poor neighborhoods of Joburg and Soweto.
For any particular reason that there would be a wave? I mean, I guess a lot was happening there in 1999 in terms of truth and reconciliation, both things.
I mean, the funny thing is Korea now has a Truth and Reconciliation Commission too.
Oh, I bet they do.
To look at abuses of the adoption system. But yeah. Oh,
and I thought you were going to say the Japanese occupation, but, you know, both things.
They have, you know, they're turning a domestic eye toward, and you know, adoptees getting their voice and being able to say, here's what happened to me in this corrupt system. So there's a parallel to apartheid. But yeah, I can only assume it's, you know, attitudes discouraging contraception and abortion.
And hard times for an extra mouth to feed.
And in general, yeah, it's always, like many things, this is compatible with Marxist thought. In many cases, it just turns out to be economics. Homelessness goes up when rents go up because...
Why?
Obviously.
I can't make the connection.
Why would it be harder to live in a home? I don't get it. So this church in Johannesburg put up a slot and said, this is our door of hope, you know, because there is something, because we're so used to objects being put into these things, library books and ATM deposits and so forth.
You just hope it's not a pneumatic tube.
Wow. No, they're, I can say unequivocally, these are not pneumatic tubes. I guess that would be, it'd be like a, reliving the birth experience.
Yeah,
you know, right. Like
there's, oh, back in,
there's a clear delimiter in your life before and after adoption. No, just, it seems a little uncomfortable to talk about babies being used, you know, it kind of treats them as objects or commodities to, when we talk about them as a export of South Korea or something you might leave in a, in basically a Goodwill donation box. But I mean, this is what allows for an option to parents who need to get, you know, who need to leave children with someone who can care for them.
It's so interesting how in history and even the present day, depending on who you are and where you stand, human life is really cheap sometimes, and human life is exceptionally overvalued other times.
Never before been better protected in a small number of cases.
But you do have right now, especially, again, I think in a social media universe where babies are a really easy thing, like dogs and cats, to put on the internet as a symbol of your own virtue, because babies don't have their own voice.
I mean, that's often That's often been the criticism of the anti-abortion movement, that they're not actually willing to advocate for people who might have warts and problems, but you know, a hypothetical fetus is never going to disappoint you. But these anonymous drop-off places do bring with them some unusual legal and ethical challenges that make them controversial. I mean, the most obvious case is analogous to these Holt-era Korean adoptions. How do we know that it was the parent who left the child?
Oh, of course. Could be an evil witch or like a lady with 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah, it could be Cruella de Vil. I think the most common case would be that the mom wants to continue to raise this baby born out of wedlock, but
her mother doesn't.
But the traditionalist parents or grandparents do not, and so they either bully the mom into giving it up or in the dead of night just take the baby to a drop-off point, and then it's the baby's gone. You know, the mom cannot solve the problem.
What if you're just a wicked neighbor and do it? Like, what a mean thing.
Well, the baby's crying next door.
Yeah, and you sneak in the night.
Church has a slot. This problem solves itself.
Because all the windows are just made of rice paper.
The anonymity is a problem because, you know, talking about adoptees now having a community, it's generally thought that you know, this is an idea that probably didn't exist 50 years ago, that these kids do have rights, you know, that you're taking a human being and saying, and so today generally it's assumed that people who were adopted do have the right to discover who their parents were if they so choose later in life.
It's really interesting about a lot of that though, is that they have rights in America using American standards, not necessarily in the place they come from. So it is like an export of a certain kind of
individualism that might not come easily in other places.
Yeah, it's the colonial conundrum of, in fighting colonialism, we are only able to use the tools of colonialism.
But you see the problem, right? That that, you know, if once these, you know, safe humanitarian drop-off spots exist,
yeah,
the child is not able to know.
Sure, and we can't know.
Right.
Would do to know would inhibit people from doing it, right? If you put a video camera there and said, show your face.
Does it encourage, and this is the other problem that is analogous to the late 20th century Korean international adoption, are we creating a system that encourages abandonment?
Right.
Like, I mean, this is also analogous to the, should there be safe places to shoot up? You know, no, we don't love it when parents give up their kids, but when they do, we certainly don't want it to be in a way that leads to babies dying of frostbite, for example.
It's one of the things I've never been able to fully interrogate, because you don't feel like, I mean, even now on this show, we're kind of talking about something that you and I,
that's
although
very hypothetical,
we both have sisters on some or other side of the adoption issue. We're just sort of like,
it's not our narrative.
But I understand completely to say we shouldn't adopt babies across racial lines. But then what is the alternative but an institutional, like, archipelago of terrible orphanages? And I'm only assuming they're terrible because anything else in our world.
Right. All other institutions of that size tends to find the lowest.
Yeah, particularly ones like we were saying that these aren't precious babies anymore. These are nine-year-old kids that have developmental disabilities. And
yeah.
I can't imagine that those things are funded to the gills. So what do you do? And I mean, I think what we should do is find a science fiction narrative for it and have orphans raised as
by robot simulacra of their actual parents.
Well, have them
such that they never believed that they were given up for adoption.
Have them be raised as a new kind of diplomatic race, like a kind of like they're a priestly caste, right? And so instead of,
because in general the opposite has happened in many cultures. They've been the lowest caste. You know, there's a word for you, and it's rootless child.
Yeah, but if there was a whole universe of I mean, because we need negotiators, we need mitigators.
If there was something about how they're, maybe they're perfectly impartial,
exactly,
because they're not connected to any existing clan,
and so we raise them in temples, and they wear specific kind of colored robes.
Well, you know what's interesting is that a lot of the medieval foundling wheel culture was built around, you know, we don't think of the Catholic Church as a progressive institution, but
no, we do not,
for obvious reasons.
Although some Catholicism is compatible with Marxism,
sure,
Central American specifically,
there's a very specific type. But you know, part of the culture that came with these foundling wheels was pushing back against these narratives that these children are somehow damned or stained by their parents' sin. You know, a lot of very common Italian last names once marked children born in this way, like there are many Italians named Innocente, and that's a last name that comes from this idea that we should consider them to be innocent of the adultery or fornication that created them.
Right.
Esposito, like the reason why people is, that's just an Italian, that's just an Italian participle meaning exposed. Like they were exposed to the elements or to the foundling wheel.
Oh.
So Esposito is a baby that's exposed. Proietto is another. Italian babies were named Trovato, meaning found. Rotile, over pertaining to wheels. Del Rio, like the reason why kids are named Del Rio is because they might have been found near a river. Gradini, found on the steps of the church. So a lot of these common surnames in these Romance languages come from
foundlings.
Their status as foundlings and some attempt to create a class and a family for them that is not one of disgrace.
How many of them were adopted by Mandalorians?
Little baby Yodas. I mean, baby Yoda's 200. You shouldn't be leaving him. How old is he? He's like 100, right?
Yeah, but he barely has language.
One solution that's been proposed in the EU recently is hospitals should just offer anonymous free birth. Like you should just be able to show up and give birth without ever giving any information about yourself as the mother, and immediately put the child in the system, you know, assuming that, you know, because there's fears that allowing for these baby hatches, you know, encourages unassisted delivery, you know, like
these
mothers are not even able to seek medical care, obstetric care for their pregnancy and childbirth.
Well, inevitably, the same people that are against needle exchanges will be like, that's just going to encourage people to have babies.
Well, it's the same thing here. You know, the same people that are against contraception and abortion are also complaining about the results of that. In the U.S., the era in which out-of-wedlock babies were plentiful is generally called the baby scoop era, which I can only assume we're supposed to imagine a big Raisin Bran scoop into a seemingly limitless well of babies.
Giant vat of babies and sprinkling them over our cornflakes.
Yeah, because there's babies for all. The baby scoop era ended pretty dramatically in the mid-70s.
What precipitated, is it just a baby boom, but the baby boom also affected the number of orphans?
I think it's a few things that took about a decade to happen, but it's the invention of the pill.
Thank you, God.
The standardization of, you know, and then as a result of that, the ability to freely buy and sell contraceptive options like the pill, and then the legalization of abortion nationwide. That's what ended the baby scoop era in America.
Oh, I see.
And as a result, today, adoption is very hard. 4 million kids were born in the U.S. last year, and only 18,000 were given up for adoption.
There were 4 million babies last year.
And only 18,000 were given up for adoption.
And how many people are trying to adopt?
Right. Yeah. It's, anecdotally, if we say that there might be 10 to 12 couples per baby, you know, it could be hundreds of thousands of people hoping to adopt a small pool of eligible babies.
Because this was always part of the rationale of turning to overseas babies.
Right. Like there's so many, and now now that does exist. You know, there are more childless parents looking for babies, but who is adoption for?
And it's no longer—
Is it for the child or is it for the parent?
It's no longer Russians are stealing Ukrainian babies.
Yeah, as I said, you know, the international adoption world is basically dead. Only 3,000 American adoptions in, I think, 2019, down from 23,000 just a decade or two before.
Huh. Well, maybe it's time for robot babies.
I see.
Yeah. I mean, we're already making robots to do a lot of things, and people are thinking, oh, there's going to be robot girlfriends and robot assistants. I'm hoping for a robot assistant. But what about a robot baby?
Do they grow? And if so, do they grow organically, or do you have to go to a store every 6 months or so and get new parts to expand your baby?
Yeah, you get an upgrade. You take the baby to the Apple store, and then they give you a slightly older baby.
They pop off the legs and put on longer legs.
Longer legs.
Or, you know, a smaller head, or
yeah,
I guess the head stays the same.
Smaller head. What kind of baby are you imagining? As it grows, the head gets smaller.
Well, I guess you can make everything else, you know, you can make everything else bigger in relation to the head, but it just seems easier as a modular solution to just pop on a smaller head.
Oh, so the baby looked proportionately like a grown up, except say the same size.
Eventually, you have an adult, but he's just
he's like the height of 18 inches long.
Isn't that what parents really want? A baby that'll never leave the house.
Whew. Well, I mean, that's the thing about a cat, right? If a cat grew up to be 6 feet tall, well, we'd all be dead.
I mean, societally, this is what we're seeing now: is cats. More and more people are choosing to More and more people are choosing to fill that baby-sized hole in their heart with a cat or a dog or a chinchilla.
Yeah, yeah. Although, yeah, right. It's the couples with a college degree that have a cat. There are a lot of people that are still having 9 kids.
If we switch to robot babies, I think you're still going to have the same problem. That eventually they're going to find each other online and form a baby adoptee group, and then we've just created a new enslaved race.
Well, except that they will together figure out how to remove their anti-human bolts, and you know, because the one will say to the other, is there a bolt on the back of my head? Will you take it off?
Do you literally think we're going to put bolts on the back of their heads?
And that's what keeps C-3PO from murdering us in our sleep.
It's the only thing.
And that concludes Foundling Wheels, entry 495.IS4915, certificate number 43431 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are not a place to go yell at us about this show or any of our shows. It's only a place that you should go to at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, or at John Roderick and praise us. You can email us if you have actual thoughts you want to share at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, but I would caution you to also only praise us. You can hang out with other futurelings who are very excited to read your praise of us and our show, and this episode in particular, wherever futurelings congregate. You can send us mail. Normally, Ken would have been opening mail throughout the show that I recorded earlier.
I have something. This is very funny. I do have something here that's addressed to John Roderick at our P.O. box.
Oh.
But it led to somebody taping this to the package. Is John Roderick belongs to this box?
Is John Roderick belongs to this
See
box?
See us at window. Have you ever asked yourself this question?
Is
John Roderick belongs to this box?
Hmm.
So many have asked.
I need to think about it. Is I belongs to this box?
If you want to send things to John, care of Omnibus, just put Omnibus on them, because otherwise it confuses the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah. So what is it?
Apparently I'm opening your mail.
Is I belongs to this
Let's
box?
Let's find out. We'll open this and see. I mean, they eventually decided yes, because they gave it to us.
Yeah. Right. Are these base belong to me?
Someone has sent you
an
XL t-shirt of Pries and Colin and Sinan.
It has a very young Adriano Celentano playing the guitar. He's so young and handsome.
I don't know if he's handsome. Maybe by Italian standards.
He's Italian handsome.
wow. Maybe he was a foundling. Maybe Celentano is what you call a baby who was found in the cellar.
This is really a nice shirt, too. It's like thick and Honduran. Well, now, why wouldn't they send you one, Ken? You love Adriano Celentano as much as I do. Oh, wait. No, you don't.
Maybe I don't.
No, I don't think you do. But
They could detect my slightly more qualified love for Adriano Celentano.
He's got that Serge Gainsbourg sort of like, is he handsome? He's extremely handsome, but also like really not handsome.
Serge Gainsbourg is not handsome.
No, but I mean, he's widely regarded as a sexy guy.
Yeah, by Belgians, I guess.
I mean, I'm just hoping that although I am not handsome, I'm widely regarded as a sexy guy. Speaking of being widely regarded as a sexy guy, you can help support Omnibus, hosted by two sexy guys. Although one of them...
We're filling in for them.
Married. So
sorry,
if
ladies.
If you're
imagine Dukes of Hazzard, but one of those hot hunks is married.
That's
what a
right.
bummer.
Well, and imagine Dukes of Hazzard where the blonde guy is... only surpassed by the other blonder guy.
It's true. We're Starsky. We're what? We're not even Starsky. We're Hutch
we're
and Hutch.
Hutch. Yeah. Hutch and Hutcher. you can go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and your generous donation will entitle you to access to, if you've never been there before, 44 episodes of our addenda show.
That's almost a full year of Omnibus.
Full year of shows where we are at our most hilarious. And if you used to subscribe, but for some reason your credit card was canceled or you went to prison for a time.
Are you a lapsed Omnibusite?
Go back and join back up because the quiver is full.
Think how much better the show has gotten since you left.
That's right. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
And John, you have a Patreon only podcast that you've started recently the last few months.
It's got about 20 episodes now, so it's been since the first of the year, and it was where I answer your letters.
That's the premise of the show. It's a
It's called it's viewer, Dear John Letters.
It's viewer mail,
and you can find it on my own Patreon at John Roderick. But don't do it if you have to take any money away from the Omnibus podcast, because otherwise we'll know.
Yeah.
We'll know, and Ken will give me 7 lashes.
Poor people, stop listening now. But if you have disposable income, continue to listen to what I'm about to say. Do not cannibalize your Omnibus Patreon donation, but if you need more John Roderick content in your life, and who doesn't?
And it comes out every Tuesday, so in some way it makes up for the missing Omnibus Tuesday show.
But again, do not cut your Omnibus donation in half.
Not, or even by any percentage, not even by 1%.
This is
only for the richest of our fans.
Are you? And you do this weekly?
It's every week. It's really the only thing other than this show that keeps me...
In a house.
Yeah, that's right. From drugs and wayward women.
It keeps you from being a foundling. There would be a 52-year-old man turning up on a porch somewhere in Burien, wrapped in a diaper like in Popeye.
Imagine how big the foundling wheel would have to be. It would have to be basically the size of a Chevy Citation.
It would have to be the size of the Wheel of Fortune. We'd place John on the lose a turn slot and spin it around to Pat Sajak, and he'll take you in. He's a good Christian.
Imagine the culture that your family would have for me to integrate into it without there being some massive cultural upheaval.
What's the opposite of Cousin Oliver, where you find a an older, less attractive person to move in with you?
Scooby-Doo not interesting enough? What about Scooby-Doo's dad?
What if your sitcom, needs a Kramer? Here's John Roderick. He's walking into your house. So what's the thing? Patreon.com/John Roderick. But only if you have extra funds left over from patreon.com/
Omnibus Project.
Oh, okay. There we go. Is that it? Is that the whole read?
That's the whole read.
Did you talk about Futurelings?
I did.
Futurelings, I've got something to tell you at this point. From our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.